Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and I want to talk about the problems that Japan face, or really the crises that Japan face, by the mid to end of the Second World War, and this relates really to the loss of shipping tonnage. There's a really interesting article written in last December's History Today by Malcolm Murfitt, that talks about this issue in particular. And the idea that Japan, whilst having a very a sudden and wildly successful few months at the start of the war, faced a naval war of attrition. Now, this is stuff I've talked about before at great length, and about how the explosive growth of Japan's East Asia co-prosperity sphere, or the Japanese Empire, suddenly faces insurmountable challenges, crises, and threats in the years after 1942. But the point that the historian here, Malcolm Murfitt, makes is that these should have been abundantly clear to Japan. Japan itself had set all sorts of extraordinary naval precedents itself since the Battle of Tsushima and the destruction of the Russian fleet in 1905. But the lessons that Japan taught to the rest of the world in terms of naval power go forgotten by about 1943-44. So let's just look at some of the statistics. Between the attack on Pearl Harbor and the surrender of Japan in August 1945, Japan loses 8.4 million tons of merchant shipping. 2,259 ships weighing over 500 tons were sunk in the Pacific War. 116,000 merchant seamen were lost. In addition to this, there was an unknown number of smaller boats, such as fishing trawlers, yachts, lighters, dinghies, and other vessels that were lost. And this matters so much because Japan is a island archipelago with few natural resources of its own and an island that was desperately dependent on the flow of goods to the island. And this is really the motivation behind the development of a vast Pacific and land Asian empire. It had been the British who'd first identified this as Japan's weakness, and the development of the Singapore strategy for imperial defence rested on, should a war break out with Japan, sailing a Royal Naval fleet from Singapore to defeat a Japanese fleet on the high seas and then lay blockade to the island. Simply starving Japan was going to be the method employed. Obviously, this didn't really work out when Japan seized Singapore from the Malay Peninsula, but it was, I suppose, a good idea in principle. The Japanese Central Planning Board had shown that Japan would require 3 million tonnes of merchant shipping to continue functioning without any shortfall. It knew that coal supplies coming from Manchuria, which it had taken in 1932, would take 1.8 million tonnes of that shipping. Agricultural products and foodstuffs would take up 450,000 tonnes, and there would be other resource components that were crucial to making steel, manganese and that sort of thing, that would take up 300,000 tonnes on an annual basis. And any reduction below the 300 million tonne level would have a huge damaging effect on the economy. So 3 million tonnes was the break-even point for Japan. The first pressure that came on Japan's merchant shipping was during the decision to go to war in December 1941. The army requisitioned 519 cargo ships and passenger vessels, for which it landed amphibious troops in Malaya and other such places. The navy took as many merchant ships. Obviously, a flotilla of non-combat ships is always required in order to service the fighting vessels. And the two forces, the army and the navy, would make during the war 9 separate allocations, 9 separate requisitions of civilian ships, thus placing an enormous burden on the Japanese merchant fleet. So the Japanese economy had a huge burden to bear from the outset, and some economic historians have suggested that the figure of 3 million tonnes is actually a conservative estimate, and some historians put it closer to 4 to 6 million tonnes. So the Japanese economy is labouring under an immense strain as a result of the war. Britain, Germany, America, and most definitely the Soviet Union went through an immensely difficult period at the beginning of each set of hostilities. Perhaps slightly less with Germany, but certainly with the other three, of transforming their economies into wartime economies. And Japan was no different. But there was an additional pressure on Japan, and that was the need for oil. Japan's oil production was relatively modest and certainly wasn't enough to cover Japanese domestic needs. Japan needed about a million tonnes of oil a year, and this wasn't factoring in the need to keep Japanese armies, air forces and navies on the go. Japan was able to produce for itself just under 400,000 tonnes of oil a year, and therefore it looked to America to make up the shortfall. Oil imports had placed Japan in a very disadvantageous position, and oil imports meant that Japan, to some extent, could be the victim of pressure from, or the recipient of, immense pressure from the United States. The Export Control Act of July 1940 meant that Japan came under a squeeze for exports, and by August 1941, not only had all oil to Japan been completely embargoed, along with scrap metal, but also, in July 1941, all Japanese assets in the US that, you know, all monies that could have bought oil, foreign currency, were frozen. Now, some economic historians have suggested that this was the spur to impulse Japan into its attack on the US, the destruction or the attempted destruction of the US Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. Was specifically designed to knock out the Great Pacific Police Force and enable Japan to seize, among other things, the Dutch East Indies, where the majority of Asia's oil was produced, and, not to forget as well, Borneo. However, a Pacific war with the US was an immense drain on Japanese resources. Some planners thought that a war with the US would take 3.6 million tonnes of fuel oil and 440,000 tonnes of aviation fuel annually. In September 1941, it was thought that Japan's oil reserves would last between 18 months and 2 years, depending on how widespread the war became. And the fact that the Pacific Fleet's carriers were not destroyed at Pearl Harbor, they weren't even there, presented the Japanese with an immense crisis. Once the carrier fleet is able to continue fighting, the war can be fought over immense distances, and America is able to carry on the fight almost indefinitely. The reality was that even if the four carriers had been destroyed at Pearl Harbor, the American war industries would still have been able to produce a vast number of new warships within a relatively short time frame. The problem that the Japanese really have is that they don't destroy the fuel reserves at Pearl Harbor. Had those been destroyed, then Pearl Harbor would not have been able to act for a considerable period of time as a forward base in the Pacific for the United States. Now, the essay that I'm referring to this afternoon makes a very salient point. It talks about how the scope of the problem is easy to map out, but the Japanese decision-making is more mysterious. Why, given the pressures of fuel and merchant shipping on Japan, did Japan not act in a more logical way to prevent these two Achilles heels, twin Achilles heels, from creating the circumstances for Japan's defeat? And in a way, it was the memory of the Battle of Tsushima that decided and influenced Japanese military planners far too readily. Japanese military planners looked at Tsushima and they said what we achieved was a fatal strike against Russia. And in the Sino-Japanese War of 1894 to 1895, we managed the same thing. And it's the decisive battle, the Trafalgar, that we seek. And only if we have that can we be in some sort of secure position. And then planning throughout the 1920s and 30s, where it was generally assumed by the Japanese Navy that a titanic war with the US would eventually come, was on a massive military, a massive naval battle somewhere in the Pacific. And indeed, this is what Japan eventually gets. Pearl Harbor was meant to be the decisive battle, the decisive strike. But Japan actually gets the Battle of the Coral Sea, the Battle of Midway, the Battle of Leyte Gulf, and a number of other battles around the Solomon Islands. And these destroy Japanese naval power in the Pacific. The Japanese neglected to look at the safety and security of their merchant shipping. They ignored the lesson that Germany had taught to Great Britain during the First World War about the power of U-boats and the response that the British had, developing a convoy system which managed, if not to stop the U-boat attacks, then to limit their effectiveness. The Japanese had actually, as allies of Britain during the First World War, had stationed observers and military attachés on British ships to witness much of this, but the lesson was lost because of the shadow that Tsushima cast over Japanese naval planning.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
There was a shortage of escort vessels, submarine hunters, destroyers, and other kind of auxiliary ships because of the need for more and more capital ships, particularly aircraft carriers. Some historians have suggested that the Japanese didn't put enough emphasis into their aircraft carriers, but they had a significantly large carrier fleet by the start of the war. Really, if any of the Axis powers had paid little or no attention to naval air power, it was Germany. The fact that there were not enough submarine hunters, destroyers, and other defensive ships meant that convoys were unprotected from air attack and from submarine attack. The Japanese had never expected America to take the offensive to them quite as quickly as they did do. They'd never expected the USA to have a submarine war against them, and they assumed that Americans were ill-disciplined, not very brave, and unlikely to be able to respond to the pressure of submarine warfare. And in 1942, indeed, there were significant problems with American submarines. There were malfunctions with torpedoes, and the next generation of submarines and torpedoes that were introduced, that were faster, were able to travel further, and their torpedoes were more accurate, meant that by 1943, a poorly protected Japanese merchant fleet, the lifeline to Japan, was in mortal danger. And 40% of shipping losses happened off the coast of Japan. These weren't ships lost out in the Pacific, they were in Japanese territorial waters. Brief experiments with convoys were ineffective, and you have to consider the economies of scale. The 1943 Casablanca Conference resulted in a policy of 3 warships per convoy plus 1 extra warship for every 10 vessels. So a standard Allied convoy of 150 ships would have 18 warships attached to it. A Japanese convoy, which should be much, much smaller, of 20 ships, would have 5 warships to escort it. And this was, the economies of scale here really don't make much sense. However, the curious thing is that Japanese military convoys that took troop ships to places like Guadalcanal or Malaya had a very effective convoy system that was covered by large numbers of warships, and it meant that the escort could be extremely close. Civilian convoys of foodstuffs to Japan, failed to adopt another strategy employed by the British and Americans in the Atlantic, of having established sailing patterns, systems of, for example, zigzagging and taking different routes to avoid submarine wolf packs. Merchant shipping captains resented the convoy system, even though it was there to keep them safe. Assembling a convoy and forming up the convoy was time-consuming, and the convoy could only go as fast as the slowest member. Many of them refused to obey radio silence. Many of them refused to control smoke emissions, thus creating lovely targets on the horizon for submarine commanders. Many of them were ignorant of things such as zigzagging, or refused to do it at night. And so the convoys, when they did exist, got broken up and were easy targets for submarines. The level of losses by 1943, however, did start to focus the thoughts of merchant navy captains. And by 1943, with the establishment of Grand Escort Headquarters, something like the British Western Approaches in Liverpool, Japanese began to really take seriously the problem of the absence of convoy duty. The Grand Escort HQ started off with 44 ships that were of any use at all. And looking back at those kind of figures before, with a convoy of 20 requiring roughly about 5 ships, you can already see how little that is, thinking about the tonnage of fuel, food and everything else needs to get into Japan. The ships were not particularly well suited to convoy duty. The lighter destroyer type ships, designed really for protecting fishing fleets initially, the Kaiboi Kan had a top speed of 20 knots, which is not quite fast enough to catch up with an American U-boat on the surface. And eventually they were equipped with 120mm guns, depth charges, and whilst these are useful, they didn't actually connect, didn't actually have any sonar or any other system like such as ASDIC for looking underwater to see if they could find American U-boats. They sometimes had minesweeping equipment, but it took a long time, almost up to 1945, before radar or sonar were equipped upon them, which is a significant problem. The air support that they had were from 80 twin-engine Betty and bombers and Emily flying boats. These were Allied descriptions of them. And the air crew were not the best. Now, there's a reason for that that's explicable. The Imperial Japanese Navy made sure that there were a limited number of pilots. Why? Because the role of pilot was analogous to samurai. It was a prestigious position. It was a knight of the air, if you will. And in order to keep its status, he didn't want to have too many of them. Unlike the United States and every other combatant power that understood mass production, who tried to churn out aircraft and train pilots as much as possible. After Japan had fought battles like Midway, the Coral Sea, and finally the Mariana Islands, Japan is hemorrhaging pilots. And the air crews towards the end of the war were not really anywhere near as good as the ones at the start. Here you have pilots that are assigned to a slightly unglamorous role of convoy protection. And they are not the best, and they, for example, don't keep radio contact with the warships and the merchant ships down below. Japanese anti-submarine warfare in general was not particularly good. The Japanese anti-submarine system was particularly weak. As I said previously, radar wasn't available to the Navy until 1943 and to patrol planes until 1944. Airborne radar was about 4 years behind that of America's in terms of quality. And the weapon that the Americans had that the Japanese lacked was the rear-firing rocket that could be launched from a Catalina or another observation plane that could hit a submarine after you'd flown over it, because normally a submarine would see a spotter plane, start to dive, and the spotter plane would overfly it and then fire backwards, in essence. The weapons that were used against American submarines were also quite weak. The depth charges were not particularly good. They sank to and it detonated at about 50 to 60 feet, whereas an American crash diving sub could hit 300 feet below the waves before the depth charges were anywhere near them. Now, by December 1944, despite the claims that the Japanese had that they had sunk hundreds and hundreds of American subs. In total, America lost about 20 subs in Japanese waters. The Americans had 156 submarines operating in the Pacific. These were the sorts of numbers that Karl Dönitz, the Grand Admiral of the Kriegsmarine, had dreamt of, that he'd be able to launch into the Atlantic. He said, with these kinds of figures, 200 subs, we'll win the war. Well, the attack groups, not wolf packs, that's a term referring to Germany, but the attack groups that followed wolf pack strategies, congregated in areas that the Japanese Navy and the Japanese Merchant Navy tended to sail through that were favoured by them. And they, in rotating patrols, they moved from one area to the next and were guided, of course, by the fact that American cryptanalysts and British cryptanalysts had broken Japan's naval codes, much as the Enigma Code had been broken to protect Allied merchant shipping in the Atlantic. Japanese codes had been broken in order to destroy Japanese merchant shipping in the Pacific. Now, of course, as we know, it was the detonation of two atomic bombs that finally ended Japan's war. But the starvation of Japan through denuding it of resources from its empire had a significant effect in bringing Japan to its knees. Why did the Japanese Navy allow such an immense open goal? Well, it's difficult to say. We can make certain predictions. But it seems to have been based deeply within Japanese assumptions about how the war would be fought and what priorities needed to be given to different aspects of the struggle. The reality is that without the destruction of the four carriers at Pearl Harbor, the war was lost from its inception anyway. Had those carriers been hit, that might have been a slightly different story, but I believe taking on the United States of America and not defeating America in the Pacific in one go, which was virtually impossible, sealed Japan's fate in 1941, and the failure to adequately protect convoys shows a degree of recklessness, which is kind of mirrored in Pearl Harbor itself, a degree of hubris and arrogance that is mirrored in Pearl Harbor itself. Anyway, I hope you found this useful and interesting. Check us out on Patreon, and also if you can give us a good review on iTunes, that'd be great, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.